standing in ranks with pikes and halberds. "Be sure to fall back as soon as they hit," Elaine yelled to them. "We want to draw them deeper." Deeper into the forest, where the Siswiamen awaited their arrival. The soldiers nodded. Elaine passed Aleandra herself, sitting her horse with a small guard surrounding her. The dark-haired queen did a horseback curtsy to Elaine. Her men had wanted their queen to join Berylaine at Mayenne's hospital, but Aleandra had refused. Perhaps seeing Elaine lead her troops directly had spurred the woman's decision. Elaine left them behind as the first Trollocs hit the wood, grunting and yelling. They'd have a difficult time fighting in the forest. The humans could use the forest cover far more effectively, ambushing the huge Trollocs barreling through the woods, skewering and hamstringing them from behind. Mobile forces of bowmen and crossbowmen could shoot from cover. If they did it right, the Trollocs wouldn't even know which direction the arrows were coming from. As Elaine led her queen's guard toward the roadway, she heard distant explosions and screams from Trollocs. The slingmen were tossing Aludra's explosive roar sticks at the Trollocs through the trees. Flashes of light reflected off dim tree trunks. Elaine reached the roadway just in time to see the Trollocs, led by several Myrdral in deep black cloaks, come pouring onto it. They could quickly flank Elaine's force, but the band of the Red Hand had already set up the dragons on the road. Talmanis stood with hands clasped behind his back, atop a pile of boxes, overlooking his force. The banner of the Red Hand flapped behind him, a bloody palm stamped on a field of red-fringed white, with Aludra yelling out measurements, aiming instructions, and the occasional curse at dragoners making mistakes or moving too slowly. Arrayed in front of Talmanis were the dragons, nearly 100 of them, strung across the broad roadway in four ranks, spilling out into the fields around the roadway here. Elaine was too far away to hear him give the order to fire. That was perhaps a good thing, for the thunder that followed shook her as if Dragonmount itself had decided to erupt. Moonshadow bucked, neighing, and Elaine had to fight to keep the animal from tossing her on her backside. In the end, she plugged the horse's ears with a weave of air as the dragoners rolled their weapons to the side and let the second rank open fire. Elaine plugged her own ears as she calmed Moonshadow. Birgitta continued fighting her own terrified mount, eventually leaping free, but Elaine paid little attention. She peered through the smoke that choked the roadway. The third line of dragons was rolling up to fire. Despite having her ears plugged, she could feel the blast jolt the ground, shake the trees. The fourth round followed, rattling her to the bones. Elaine breathed in and out, stilling her heart, waiting for the smoke to clear. First she made out Talmanis, standing tall. The first line of dragons had rolled back into place, reloaded. The other three ranks were hastily doing their own reloads, slipping powder and the large metal spheres into place. A strong breeze from the west cleared the smoke enough for her to see. Elaine gasped softly. Thousands of Trollocs lay in smoldering pieces, many blown off the road completely. Arms, legs, strands of coarse hair, pieces lay scattered amid holes in the ground fully 2 paces wide. Where there had once been many thousands of Trollocs, only blood, broken bones, and smoke remained. Many of the trees had been shattered into splintered trunks. Of the Myrdral that had been at the front, there was no sign at all. The dragoners lowered their flame sticks, not firing their reloaded rounds. A few surviving Trollocs near the back scrambled away into the forest. Elaine looked at Birgitta and grinned. The warder looked on, solemn, while several guardswomen ran to chase down her horse. "Well?" Elaine asked, unstopping her ears. "I think," Birgitta said, "those things are messy." and imprecise. And bloody effective. Yes, Elaine said proudly. Birgitta shook her head. Her horse was returned to her and she remounted. I used to think that a man and his bow were the most dangerous combination this land would ever know, Elaine. Now, as if it weren't bad enough that men channel openly and the Shan Chan use channelers in combat, we have those things. I don't like the way this is going. If any boy with a tube of metal can destroy an entire army... Don't you see? Elaine said. There won't be war anymore. We win this, and there will be peace, as Rand intends. Nobody but Trollocs would go into battle knowing they face weapons like these. Perhaps, Birgitta said. She shook her head. Maybe I have less faith in the wisdom of people than you do. Elaine sniffed, raising her sword to Talmanis, who drew his and raised it back. The first step in destroying this Trolloc army had been taken. Chapter 11 Just Another Sellsword. I realize there have been disagreements between us in the past, Adalorna Bastine said, riding beside Egwene as they passed through camp. Adalorna was a slim, regal woman. Her tilted eyes and dark hair bespoke her Saldaean heritage. I would not have you consider us enemies. I have not, Egwene said carefully, and do not. She did not ask what Adalorna meant by using the word us. She was green, and Egwene had suspected for a time that she was the Captain General, the name the Greens gave to the head of their Aja. That is well, Adalorna said. Some within the Aja have acted in foolishness. They have been informed of their mistakes. You will find no further resistance from those who should have loved you best, Mother. Whatever has passed, let it be buried. Let it be buried, Egwene agreed, amused. Now, she thought, after all of this, the Greens try to claim me? Well, she would use them. She'd been worried that her relationship with them was beyond repair. Choosing Sylviana as her keeper had made many determined to treat her as an enemy. Egwene had heard whispers that many thought she would have chosen the Red as her Aja, despite the fact that she not only had a warder, but had married him. If I may ask, Egwene said, is there a particular incident which has brought about this bridge across our difficulties? Some are willfully ignorant of what you did during the Shan Chan invasion, Mother, Adalorna said. You proved to have the spirit of a warrior, of a general. This is something the Green Aja must not ignore. Indeed, we must embrace it as an example. So it has been decided, and so those who lead the Aja have spoken. Adalorna met Egwene's eyes, then bowed her head. The implication was obvious. Adalorna was the head of the Green Aja. To speak it outright would not be appropriate. But to give Egwene this knowledge was to give a measure of trust and respect. If you had truly been raised from us, the action said, you would have known who led us, you would have known our secrets. I give them to you. There was also gratitude to the motion. Egwene had saved Adalorna's life during the Shan Chan assault of the White Tower. The Ummerlin was of no Aja, and Egwene actually expressed this virtue more than any before her, for she never had belonged to an Aja. Still, this gesture was moving. She rested her hand on Adalorna's arm in thanks, then gave her leave to depart. Gawain, Sylviana, and Lyalwyn rode off to the side, where Egwene had sent them after Adalorna asked for a private word. That Shan Chan... Egwene vacillated between keeping her close to watch her and sending her far, far away. Lyllwyn's information about the Seanchan had been useful. So far as she could determine, Lyllwyn had told her the exact truth. For now, Egwene kept her close, if only because she frequently thought of more questions about the Seanchan. Lyllwyn acted more like a bodyguard than a prisoner, as if Egwene would trust her safety to one of the Seanchan. She shook her head, riding among the gathered tents and campfires of the army. Most were empty, as Bryn had the men forming battle lines. He expected the Trolloc approach within the hour. Egwene found Bryn calmly organizing his maps and papers in a tent near the center of the camp. Yukiri was there, arms folded. Egwene dismounted and went in. Bryn looked up sharply. "Mother," he exclaimed, causing her to freeze. She looked down. There was a hole in the floor of the tent, and she had nearly stepped into it. It was a gateway. The other side appeared to open into the air itself, looking down on the Trolloc army, which was crossing the hills. The recent week had involved many skirmishes, with Egwene's archers and riders slaughtering Trollocs who marched in force toward the hills and the border into Arafel. Egwene peered through this gateway in the floor. It was high up, well outside of bow range, but looking down through it at the Trollocs made her dizzy. "I'm not sure if this is brilliant," she said to Bryn, "or incredibly foolhardy." Bryn smiled, turning back to his maps. "Winning wars is about information, Mother. If I can see exactly what they are doing, where they are trying to envelop us and how they are bringing in reserves, I can prepare. This is better than a battle tower. I should have thought of it ages ago." "The Shadow has dreadlords who can channel, General," Egwene said. "Peeking through this gateway could get you burned to a crisp. That's not to mention Drakkar. If a flock of them tried to fly through this..."
"Drakkar are shadow spawn," Bryn said. "I've been told that they'd die passing through the gateway."
"I guess that's true," Egwene said. "But you'd have a flock of dead Drakkar in here. Regardless, channelers can still attack through it."
"I will take that chance. The advantage offered is incredible."
"I'd still rather you use scouts to look through the gateway," Egwene said. "Not your own eyes. You are a resource, one of our most valuable. Risks are unavoidable, but please take care to minimize them."
"Yes, Mother," he said.
She inspected the weaves, then eyed Yukiri. "I volunteered, Mother," Yukiri said before Egwene could ask how a sitter ended up doing simple gateway duty. "He sent to us, asking if forming a gateway like this, horizontal instead of vertical, was possible. I thought it an interesting puzzle." She was not surprised he had sent to the Greys. There was a growing sentiment among them that, just as the Yellows specialized in healing weaves and the Greens specialized in battle weaves, the Greys should take particular interest in weaves for traveling. They seemed to consider travel part of their calling as mediators and ambassadors. "Can you show me our own lines?" Egwene asked. "Certainly, Mother," Yukiri said, closing the gateway. She opened another, letting Egwene look down on the battle lines of her army as they formed up in defensive positions on the hills. This was more efficient than maps. No map could completely convey the lay of a land, the way that troops moved. Egwene felt as if she were looking at an exact replica of the landscape in miniature. Vertigo hit her suddenly. She was standing at the edge of a drop of hundreds of feet. Her mind reeled, and she stepped back, taking a deep breath. "You need to put a rope up around this thing," Egwene said. "Someone could step right off. Or pitch head first while staring down." Bryn grunted.
I sent Swan for something like that.
He hesitated.
She didn't much like being sent, though, so she might come back with something completely useless.
I keep wondering, Yukiri said. Shouldn't there be a way to create a gateway like this, but make it so it can only let light through? Like a window. You could stand on it and look down without fearing that you could slip through. With the right weaves, you might be able to make it invisible from the other side.
Stand on it? Light! You'd have to be mad.
Lord Bryn, Egwene said. Your battle lines seem very solid. Thank you, Mother. They're also lacking.
Bryn raised his head.
Other men might have risen to the challenge, but he did not. Perhaps it was all of that practice in dealing with Morghese. How so?
You form up the troops as usual, Egwene said. Archers at the front and on the hills to slow the enemy advance. Heavy cavalry to charge and hit, then withdraw. Pikes to hold the line, light cavalry to protect our flanks and keep us from being surrounded.
The soundest battle strategies are often those that are time-tested, Bryn said. We may have a large force, with all of those dragons sworn, but we're still outnumbered. We can't be more aggressive than I've been here.
Yes, you can be, Egwene said calmly. She met his eyes. This is unlike any battle you've ever fought, and your army is not like any you've ever led, General. You have a major advantage that you are not taking into account.
You mean the Aes Sedai?
Bloody right I do, she thought. Light. She'd been spending too much time around Elaine.
I did account for you, Mother, Bryn said. I had planned for the Aes Sedai to be a reserve force to aid companies in disengaging so we can rotate in fresh troops.
Pardon, Lord Bryn, Egwene said. Your plans are wise, and certainly some of the Aes Sedai should be used that way. However, the White Tower did not prepare and train for thousands of years to sit out the last battle as a reserve force.
Bryn nodded, slipping a new set of documents out from underneath his pile. I did consider other more dynamic possibilities, but I did not want to overstep my authority.
He handed her the documents. Egwene scanned them, raising an eyebrow. Then she smiled.
Matt had not remembered so many tinkers around Ebu Dar. Brilliantly colored wagons grew like vibrant mushrooms on an otherwise dun field. There were enough of them to make a bloody city. A city of tinkers? That would be like a city of Aiel. It was just wrong. Matt trotted Pips along the roadway. Of course, there was an Aiel city. Maybe there would be a Tinker city someday, too. They would buy up all of the colored dye, and everyone else in the world would have to wear brown. There would be no fighting in the city, so it would be downright boring. But there also would not be a single bloody pot with a hole in the bottom for 30 leagues. Matt smiled, patting Pips. He had covered over his Ashandarai as best he could to make it look like a walking pole strapped to the side of the horse. His hat lay inside the pack he had hung from the saddlebags, along with all of his nice coats. He had ripped the lace off the one he wore. It was a shame, but he did not want to be recognized. He wore a crude bandage wrapped around the side of his head, covering his missing eye. As he approached the Dalaira gate, he fell into line behind the others awaiting permission to enter. He should look just like another wounded sellsword riding into the city, seeking refuge or perhaps work. He made certain to slump in the saddle. Keep your head down. Good advice on the battlefield and when entering a city where people knew you. He could not be Matrim Cawthon here. Matrim Cawthon had left the queen of this city tied up to be murdered. Many would suspect him of the murder. Lighty would have suspected himself. Veslin would hate him now, and there was no telling how Tuon would feel about him, now that they had had some time apart. Yes, best to keep his head down and stay quiet. He would feel the place out, If, that was, he ever reached the front of this bloody line, who ever heard of a line to enter a city? Eventually, he reached the gate. The bored soldier there had a face like an old shovel. It was half covered in dirt and would be better off locked in a shed somewhere. He looked Matt up and down.
"You have sworn the oaths, traveler?" the guard asked in a lazy Shan-Chan drawl.
On the other side of the gate, a different soldier waved over the next person in line.
"Yes, I have indeed," Matt said. "The oaths to the great Shan-Chan Empire and the Empress herself, may she live forever. I'm just a poor traveling sellsword, once attendant to House Hawk, a noble family in Murundi. I lost my eye to some bandits in the Tween Forest 2 years back while protecting a young child I discovered in the woods. I raised her as my own, but..."
The soldier waved him on.
The fellow did not look as if he had been listening.
Matt considered staying put out of principle. Why would the soldiers force people to wait in such a long line and give them time to think of a cover story only not to hear it out? That could offend a man. Not Matram Cawthon, who was always light-hearted and never offended. But someone else, surely. He rode on, containing his annoyance. Now he just needed to make his way to the right tavern. Pity Satala's place was not an option any longer. That had... Matt stiffened in the saddle, though Pips continued his leisurely pace forward. Matt had just taken a moment to look at the other guard at the gate. It was Petra, the strong man from Balan Luka's menagerie. Matt looked the other way and slumped again in his saddle, then shot another glance over his shoulder. That was Petra, all right. There was no mistaking those log arms and that tree stump neck. Petra was not a tall man, but he was so wide an entire army could have taken shade in his shadow. What was he doing back in Ebu Dar? Why was he wearing a Shan-Chan uniform? Matt almost went over to talk to him, as they had always been amiable, but that Shan-Chan uniform made him reconsider. Well, at least his luck was with him. If he had been sent to Petra instead of the guard he had ended up talking to, he would have been recognized for sure. Matt breathed out, then climbed down to lead Pips. The city was crowded, and he did not want the horse pushing someone over. Besides, Pips was laden down enough to look like a pack horse, if the looker knew nothing of horses, and walking might make Matt less memorable. Perhaps he should have started his search for a tavern in the Rahad. Rumors were always easy to find in the Rahad, as was a game of dice. It was also the easiest place to find a knife in your gut, and that was saying something in Ebu Dar. In the Rahad, people were as likely to take out their knives and begin killing as they were to say hello in the morning. He did not go into the Rahad. The place looked different now. There were soldiers camped outside it. Generations of successive rulers in Ebu Dar had allowed the Rahad to fester unchecked, but the Shan-Chan were not so inclined. Matt wished them luck. The Rahad had fought off every invasion so far. Light. Rand should have just hidden there, instead of going up to fight the last battle. The Trollocs and Dark Friends would have come for him, and the Rahad would have left them all unconscious in an alley, their pockets turned inside out and their shoes sold for soup money. Matt caught a glimpse of Rand shaving, but he squashed the image. Matt shouldered his way over a crowded canal bridge, keeping a close eye on his saddlebags. But so far, not a single cut purse had tried for them. With a Shan-Chan patrol on every other corner, he could see why. As he passed a man yelling out the day's news, with hints that he had good gossip for a little coin, Matt found himself smiling. He was surprised at how familiar, even comfortable, this city felt. He had liked it here. Though he could vaguely remember grumbling about wanting to be away, probably just after the wall fell on him, as Matram Cawthon was not often one for grumbling, he now realized that his time in Ebu Dar had been among the best of his life. Plenty of cards and dice in the city. Tylin, bloody ashes, but that had been a fun game. She had had the better of him time and again. Light sent him plenty of women who could do that, though not in rapid succession, and always when he knew how to find the back door. Tuan was one. Come to think of it, he would probably never need another. She was enough of a handful for any man. Matt smiled, patting Pips on the neck. The horse blew down Matt's neck in return. Strangely, this place felt more like home to him than the Two Rivers did. Yes, the Ebu Dari were prickly, but all peoples had their quirks. In fact, as Matt thought about it, he had never met a people who were not prickly about one thing or another. The Borderlanders were baffling, and so were the Aiel. That went without saying. The Kyrianen and their strange games, the Tyrans and their ridiculous hierarchies, the Seanchan and their Seanchan-ness. That was the truth of it. Everyone outside the Two Rivers, and to a lesser extent Andor, was bloody insane. A man just had to be ready for that. He strolled along, careful to be polite, lest he find a knife in his gut. The air smelled of 100 sweetmeats, the chattering crowd a low roar in his ears. The Ebu Dari still wore their colorful outfits. Maybe that was why the tinkers had come here, drawn to the bright colors like soldiers drawn to dinner. Anyway, the Ebu Dari women wore dresses with tight-laced tops that showed plenty of bosom. Not that Matt looked. Their skirts had colorful petticoats underneath, and they pinned up the side or front to show them off. That never had made sense to him. Why put the colorful parts underneath? And if you did, why take such pains to cover them over, then go around with the outside pinned up? The men wore long vests that were equally colorful, perhaps to hide the bloodstains when they were stabbed. No point in throwing away a good vest just because the fellow wearing it was murdered for inquiring after the weather. Though, as Matt walked along, he found fewer jewels than he had expected. They never had been as common in this part of the city as in the Rahad, but some days he had hardly been able to take two steps without passing a pair of men with knives out. This day he saw not a single one. Some of the Ebu Dari, you could often tell them by their olive skin, were parading around in Seanchan dress. Everyone was very polite. As polite as a 6-year-old boy who had just heard that you had a fresh apple pie back in the kitchen. The city was the same, but different. The feel was off a shade or two. And it was not just that there were no seafolk ships in the harbor any longer. It was the Seanchan, obviously. They'd made rules since he'd left. What kind? Matt took Pips to a stable that seemed reputable enough. A quick glance at their stock told him that. They were caring well for the animals, and many were very fine. It was best to trust a stable with fine horses, though it cost you a little more. He left Pips, took his bundle, and used the still-wrapped Ashandarai as a walking staff. Choosing the right tavern was as tough as choosing a good wine. You wanted one that was old, but not broken down. Clean, but not too clean. A spotless tavern was one that never saw any real use. Matt could not stand the types of places where people sat around quietly and drank tea, coming there primarily to be seen. No, a good tavern was worn and used, like good boots. It was also sturdy, again like good boots. So long as the ale did not taste like good boots, you would have a winner. The best places for information were over in the Rahad, but his clothing was too nice to visit, and he did not want to run into whatever the Seanchan were doing there. He stuck his head into an inn named the Winter Blossom and immediately turned around and stalked away. Death Watch guards in uniform. He did not want to take any slight chance of running into Furik Kharid. The next inn was too well lit, and the next too dark. After about an hour of hunting, and not a duel to be seen, he began to despair of ever finding the right place. Then he heard dice tumbling in a cup. At first he jumped, thinking it was those blasted dice in his head. Fortunately, it was just ordinary dice. Blessed, wonderful dice. The sound was gone in a moment, carried on the wind through the throng of people in the streets. Hand on his coin purse, pack over his shoulder, he pushed through the crowd, muttering a few apologies. In a nearby alleyway, he saw a sign hanging from a wall. He stepped up to it, reading the words, "The Yearly Brawl," in copper on its face. It had a picture of clapping people and the sounds of dice mixed with the smells of wine and ale. Matt stepped inside. A round-faced Shonchan stood just inside the door, leaning casually against the wall, a sword on his belt. He gave Matt a distrustful stare. Well, Matt had never met a shoulder-thumper who did not give that look to every man who entered. Matt reached up to tip his hat to the man, but of course he was not wearing it. Bloody ashes. He felt naked without it sometimes.
Jim, a woman called from beside the bar, you aren't glaring at customers again, are you?
Only the ones that deserve it, Kathana,
the man called back with a Shonchan slur.
I'm sure this one does.
I'm just a humble traveler, Matt said, looking for some dicing and some wine. Nothing more.
Certainly not trouble.
And that's why you're carrying a pole arm, Jame asked. Wrapped up like that?
Oh, stop it, the woman Kathana said. She had crossed the common room and took Matt by the sleeve of his coat, dragging him toward the bar. She was a short thing, dark-haired and fair-skinned. She was not that much older than he was, but she had an unmistakable motherly air.
Don't mind him. Just don't make trouble and he won't be forced to stab you, kill you, or anything in between.
She plunked Matt down on a bar stool and started busying herself behind the bar. The common room was dim, but in a friendly way. People diced at one side, the good kind of dicing, the kind that had people laughing or clapping their friends on the back at a good-natured toss. No haunted eyes of men gambling their last coin here.
You need food, Kathana declared. You have the look of a man who hasn't eaten anything hearty in a week. How'd you lose that eye?
I was a Lord's Guard in Murindi, Matt said. Lost it in an ambush.
That's a great lie, Kathana said, slapping a plate down in front of him, full of slices of pork and gravy.
Better than most. You said it really straight, too. I almost believe you. Jame, you want food?
I have to guard the door, he called back.
Light man, you expect someone to walk off with it? Get over here.
Jame grumbled, but made his way over to the bar beside Matt, settling down on a stool. Kathana put a mug of ale down, and he took it up to his lips, staring straight ahead.
I'm watching you, he muttered to Matt.
Matt was not certain this was the right inn for him, but he also was not certain he would be able to escape with his head unless he ate the woman's food as instructed. He took a taste. It was pretty good. She had moved over and was wagging a finger while lecturing a man at one of the tables. She seemed the type who would lecture a tree for growing in the wrong spot. This woman, Matt thought, must never be allowed to enter the same room as Nynaeve, at least not when I'm within shouting distance. Kathana came bustling back. She wore a marriage knife at her neck, though Matt did not stare for more than a few seconds on account of him being a married man. She had her skirt pinned up on the side after the fashion of Ebu Dari commoners. As she came back to the bar and ready to plate of food for Jame, Matt noticed him watching her fondly and made a guess.
You two been married long?
Matt asked. Jame eyed him.
No, he finally said. Haven't been on this side of the ocean for long.
I suppose that would make sense, Matt said, taking a drink of the ale she set before him. It was not bad, considering how awful most things tasted these days. This was only a little awful. Kathana walked over to the dicing men and demanded they eat more food, as they were looking pale. It was a wonder this Jame fellow did not weigh as much as 2 horses. She did talk some, though, so perhaps he could wiggle the information he needed out of her.
There don't seem to be as many jewels as there used to be, Matt said to her as she passed.
That's because of a Shonchan rule, Kathana said, from the new empress. May she live forever. She didn't forbid jewels entirely, and a bloody good thing she didn't. The Ebu Dari won't riot at something as unimportant as being conquered. But take away our duels, then you'll see something. Anyway, duels now have to be witnessed by an official of the government. You can't duel without answering 100 different questions and paying a fee. It's drained the whole life out of it all. It has saved lives, James said. Men can still die by each other's knives if they are determined. They simply have to give themselves time to cool down and think.
Duels aren't about thinking, Kathana said.
But I suppose it does mean that I don't have to worry about your pretty face being cut up on the street.
James snorted, resting his hand on his sword. The hilt, Matt noticed for the first time, was marked with herons, though he could not see if the blade was or not. Before Matt could ask another question, Kathana marched away and began squawking at some men who had spilled ale on their table. She did not seem the type to stand in one place for very long.
"How's the weather to the north?" Jame asked, eyes still straight ahead.
"Dreary," Matt replied honestly. "As everywhere."
"Men say it's the last battle," James said.
"It is,"
James grunted. "If it is, it would be a bad time for interfering with politics, wouldn't you think?"
"Bloody right it would be," Matt said. "People need to stop playing games and have a look at the sky."
James eyed him. "That's the truth. You should listen to what you are saying."
Light, Matt thought. He must think I'm a spy of some sort.
"That's not my choice," Matt said. "Sometimes people only listen to what they want to hear."
He took another bite of his meat, which tasted as good as could be expected. Eating a meal these days was like going to a dance where there were only ugly girls. This, however, was among the better of the bad that he had had the misfortune of eating lately.
"A wise man might just learn the truth," James said.
"You have to find the truth first," Matt said. "It's harder than most men think."
From behind, Kathana snorted, bustling past. "The truth is something men debate in bars when they're too drunk to remember their names. That means it's not in good company. I wouldn't put too much stock in it, traveler."
"The name's Mandevwin," Matt said. "I'm sure it is," Kathana said. She looked him over then.
"Has anyone ever told you that you should wear a hat? It would fit the missing eye quite well."
"Is that so?" Matt said dryly. "You give fashion advice as well as force-feeding men?"
She swatted him on the back of the head with her cleaning rag.
"Eat your food."
"Look, friend," James said, turning toward him. "I know what you are and why you're here. The fake eye bandage is not fooling me. You have throwing knives tucked into your sleeves and 6 more on your belt that I can count. I've never met a man with one eye who can throw worth a dried bean. She's not as easy a target as you foreigners think. You'll never make it into the palace, let alone through her bodyguards. Go find some honest work instead."
Matt gaped at the man. He thought Matt was an assassin? Matt reached up and took off the bandage, exposing the hole where his eye had been. James stared at that.
"There are assassins," Matt said calmly, "after Tuon."
"Don't use her name like that," Kathana said, beginning to snap her cleaning rag at him again. Matt reached up beside his head without looking, catching the tip of the rag. He held James' eyes with his single one, not flinching.
"There are assassins," Matt repeated calmly, "after Tuon."
James nodded.
"Mostly foreigners who don't know the right way of things. Several have moved through the inn. Only one admitted the reason he was here. I saw that his blood fed the dusty earth of the dueling grounds."
"Then I count you a friend," Matt said, standing. He reached into his bundle and took out his hat and put it upon his head.
"Who is behind it? Who has brought them in? Put the bounty on her head."
Nearby, Kathana inspected his hat and nodded in satisfaction. Then she hesitated and squinted at his face.
"This isn't what you think," James said. "He isn't hiring the best assassins. They're foreigners, so they aren't meant to succeed."
"I don't care how bloody likely their chances are," Matt said. "Who is hiring them?"
"He's too important for you to..."
"Who?" Matt said softly.
"General Lunal Galgan," James said. "Head of the Shonshan armies. I can't make you out, friend. Are you an assassin, or are you here hunting assassins?"
"I'm no bloody assassin," Matt said, pulling the brim of his hat down and picking up his bundle.
I never kill a man unless he demands it. Demands it with screams and thunder so loudly, I figure it would be impolite not to agree to the request. If I stab you, friend, you'll know that it is coming, and you will know why. I promise you that.
Jame, Kathana hissed. It's him.
What now? Jame asked as Matt brushed past, raising his covered Ashendari to his shoulder.
The one the guards have been looking for, Kathana said.
She looked to Matt.
Light, every soldier in Ebudar has been told to watch for your face. How did you make it through the city gates?
By luck, Matt said, then stepped out into the alleyway.
What are you waiting for?
Moraine asked. Rand turned toward her. They stood in Lan's command tent in Shinar. He could smell the smoke of burning fields set aflame by Lan and Lord Aglamar's troops as they withdrew from the gap. They were burning the lands they would rather defend. A desperate tactic, but a good one. It was the sort of all-in tactic that Luce Theron and his people in the Age of Legends had been hesitant to try, at least at first. It had cost them dearly then. The Borderlanders showed no such timidity.
Why are we here?
Moraine pressed, stepping up to him. His maidens guarded the tent from the inside. Better to not let the enemy know Rand was here.
You should be at Shale Ghul right now. That is your destiny, Randall Thor. Not these lesser fights.
My friends die here.
I thought you were beyond such weaknesses.
Compassion is not a weakness.
Is it not?
She said.
And if, in sparing your enemy because of compassion, you allow them to kill you, what then, Randall Thor?
He had no answer.
You cannot risk yourself, Moraine said. And regardless of whether or not you agree that compassion itself can be a weakness, acting foolishly because of it certainly is.
He had often thought about the moment when he had lost Moraine. He had agonized over her death, and he still reveled in her return. At times, however, he had forgotten how insistent she could be.
I will move against the Dark One when the time is right, Rand said, but not before. He must think I am with the armies, that I am waiting to seize more ground before striking at him. We must coax his commanders to commit their forces southward, lest we be overwhelmed at Shale Ghul once I enter.
It will not matter, Moraine said. You will face him, and that will be the time of determination. All spins on that moment, Dragon Reborn. All threads in the pattern are woven around your meeting, and the turning of the wheel pulls you toward it. Do not deny that you feel it.
I feel it.
Then go.
Not yet.
She took a deep breath.
Stubborn as ever.
And a good thing, Rand said. Stubbornness is what brought me this far. Rand hesitated, then fished in his pocket. He came out with something bright and silvery, a Tarvalan mark. Here, he said, holding it out to her. I've been saving this. She pursed her lips.
It cannot be.
The same one? No. That is long lost, I fear. I've been carrying this one around as a token, almost without realizing what I'd been doing. She took the coin, turning it over in her fingers. She was still inspecting it when the maidens looked with alertness toward the tent flap. A second later, Lan lifted the flap and strode in, flanked by two Malkieri men. The three could have been brothers, with those grim expressions and hard faces. Rand stepped up, resting his hand on Lan's shoulder. The man did not look tired. A stone could not look tired. But he did look worn. Rand understood that feeling. Lan nodded to him, then looked at Moraine.
Have you two been arguing?
Moraine tucked the mark away, face becoming impassive. Rand didn't know what to make of the interaction between the two of them since Moraine's return. They were civil, but there was a distance between them that he had not expected.
You should listen to Moraine, Lan said, turning back to Rand. She has prepared for these days longer than you have been alive. Let her guide you. She wants me to leave this battlefield, Rand said, and strike immediately for Shale Ghul instead of trying to fight those channelers for you so you can retake the gap. Lan hesitated. Then perhaps you should do as she... No, Rand said. Your position here is dire, old friend. I can do something, and so I will. If we can't stop those dreadlords, they'll have you retreating all the way back to Tarvalin. I have heard what you did at Maradon, Lan said. I will not turn away a miracle here if one is determined to find us. Maradon was a mistake, Moraine said tersely. You cannot afford to expose yourself, Rand. I cannot afford not to, either. I won't just sit back and let people die. Not when I can protect them. The Borderlanders do not need to be sheltered, Lan said. No, Rand replied. But I've never known one who would refuse a sword when one was offered in a time of need. Lan met his eyes, then nodded. Do what you can. Rand nodded to the two maidens, who nodded back. Sheepherder, Lan said. Rand raised an eyebrow. Lan saluted him, arm across his chest, bowing his head. Rand nodded back. There is something for you on the floor over there, Daishan. Lan frowned, then walked to a pile of blankets. There were no tables in this tent. Lan knelt, then raised a bright, silvery crown, thin yet strong. The crown of Malkir, he whispered. This was lost. My smiths did what they could with old drawings, Rand said. The other is for Nynaeve. I think it will suit her. You have ever been a king, my friend. Elaine taught me to rule, but you taught me how to stand. Thank you. He turned to Moraine. Keep a space clear for my return. Rand seized the one power and opened a gateway. He left Lan kneeling, holding the crown, and followed his maidens out onto a black field. Burned stalks crunched beneath his boots, and smoke wreathed the air. The maidens immediately sought shelter in a small depression in the field, huddling against the blackened earth, prepared to weather the storm. Because one was certainly brewing. Trollocs milled in a large mass before Rand, prodding at the soil and at the remains of farmhouses. The River Mora rushed nearby. This was the first cultivated land south of Tarwin's Gap. Lan's forces had burned it before preparing to retreat downriver ahead of the Trolloc advance. There were tens of thousands of the beasts here, perhaps more. Rand raised his arms, forming a fist, drawing in a deep breath. In the pouch at his belt he carried a familiar object, the small fat man with the sword, the Angreal he had recently found at Dumai's Wells. He had returned there for one last look and found it buried in the mud. It had been useful at Maradon. Nobody knew he had it. That was important. But there was more to what he would do here than tricks. Trollocs shouted as the winds whipped up around Rand. This was not the result of channeling. Not yet. It was Rand. Being here. Confronting him. Seas grew choppy when different streams of water crashed into one another. Winds grew powerful when hot air and cool mixed. And where light confronted shadow, storms grew. Rand shouted, letting his nature stir the tempest. The Dark One pressed upon the land, seeking to smother it. The pattern needed equalization. It needed balance. It needed the dragon. The winds grew more powerful, lightning breaking the air, black dust and burned stalks flipping up, twisting about in the maelstrom. Rand finally channeled as Murdral forced the Trollocs to attack him. The beasts charged against the wind, and Rand directed the lightning. It was so much easier to direct than control. With a storm already in place, he didn't need to force the lightning. He needed only to cajole it. Strikes destroyed the front groups of Trollocs, 100 bolts of lightning in succession. The pungent scent of burnt flesh swirled in the storm, joining the charred stalks of grain. Rand roared as the Trollocs kept coming. Death gates sprang up around him, gateways that zipped across the ground like water striders, sweeping Trollocs into death. Shadowspawn could not survive traveling. The storm winds rose around Rand as he struck down those Trollocs who tried to reach him. The Dark One thought to rule here. He would see this land already had a king. He would see that the fight would not. A shield tried to sever Rand from the source. He laughed, spinning, trying to pinpoint the shield's origin.
Taim! He yelled, though the storm captured his voice and overwhelmed it. I had hoped you would come.
This was the fight that Luz Theron had constantly demanded of him, a fight Rand hadn't dared begin. Not until now. Not until he had control. He summoned his strength, but then another shield struck at him, and another. Rand drew in more of the One Power, tapping nearly all that he could through the fat man Ongrial. Shields continued to snap at him like biting flies. None were strong enough to sever him from the source, but there were dozens of them. Rand calmed himself. He sought peace, the peace of destruction. He was life, but he was also death. He was the manifestation of the land itself. He struck, destroying an unseen dreadlord hiding in the rubble of a burned building nearby. He summoned fire and directed it at a second, burning him to nothingness. He could not see the weaves of the women out there. He could only feel their shields. Too weak. Each shield was too weak, and yet their attacks had him worried. They had come quickly, at least 3 dozen dreadlords, each trying to cut him off from the source. This was dangerous, that they had anticipated him. That was why they had hit land so hard with channelers, to draw Rand out. Rand fought off the attacks, but none of them were in danger of truly shielding him. A single person could not cut off someone holding as much Sayadine as he was. They should have... He saw it right before it happened. The other attacks were cover, feints. One that was coming would be created by a circle of men and women. A man would be leading. There! A shield slammed against him, but Rand had just enough time to prepare. He channeled spirit in the tempest, weaving by instinct from Luz Theron's memories, and rebuffed the shield. He shoved it away, but could not destroy it. Light. That had to be a full circle. Rand grunted as the shield slipped closer to him. It made a vibrant pattern in the sky, motionless despite the tempest. Rand resisted it with his own surge of spirit and air, holding it back as if it were a knife hanging above his throat. He lost control of the tempest. Lightning crashed around him. The other channelers wove to enhance the storm. They didn't try to control it, but they didn't need to. It being out of control served them, as at any moment it could strike Rand. He roared again, louder this time, more determined.
I will beat you, Taim. I will finally do what I should have done months ago.
But he did not let the anger, the wildness, force him into conflict. He couldn't afford to. He had learned better than that. This was not the place. He could not fight here. If he did, he would lose. Rand pushed with a surge of strength, throwing back Taim's shield, then used the moment of respite to weave a gateway. His maidens went through immediately, and Rand, ducking his head against the wind, reluctantly followed. He leaped into Lan's tent, where Moiraine had done as he requested and kept space open for him. He closed his gateway, and the winds stilled, the noise dampened. Rand formed a fist, panting, sweat running down the sides of his face. Here, back with Lan's army, the tempest was distant, although Rand could hear it rumbling, and faint winds stirred the tent. Rand had to fight to keep from sinking to his knees. He sucked in large breaths. With difficulty, he slowed his racing heart and brought calmness to his face. He wanted to fight, not run. He could have beaten Taim. and in so doing would have weakened himself so far that the Dark One would have taken him with ease. He forced his fist to open and wrestled control of his emotions. He looked up at Moiraine's calm, knowing face.
"It was a trap?" she asked.
"Not so much a trap," Rand said, "as a battlefield well prepared with sentinels. They know what I did at Maradon. They must have teams of dreadlords waiting to travel to wherever I'm spotted and attack me."
"You have seen the error in this line of attack?" she asked.
"Error? No. Inevitability? Yes." He couldn't fight this war personally. Not this time. He would have to find another way to protect his people.
Chapter 12. A Shard of a Moment. Birgitta dashed through the forest, accompanied by a group of 30 Aiel, all with bows out. They made sound. They couldn't help but make sound. But the Aiel made less than they should. They would leap up onto fallen logs and run deftly along them, or would find stones to step upon. They would writhe out of the way of hanging branches, ducking, twisting, moving. "Here," she said in a hushed tone, rounding the side of a broken hill. Fortunately, the cave was still there, overgrown with vines, a small creek running past it. The Aiel ducked in, the water removing any scent of their passage. Two of the men continued down the game trail, now moving much more loudly, scraping against every branch they passed. Birgitta joined the ones hiding in the cavern. It was dark inside and smelled of mold and earth. Had she hidden in this cave, centuries ago when she'd lived in these woods as a bandit? She didn't know. She rarely remembered any of her past lives. Sometimes only fleeting memories of the in-between years during her life in the world of dreams before being brought into this world unnaturally by Mogadine. She considered that with sickness. It was all right to be reborn, fresh and new, but to have her memories, her very sense of self, ripped away? If she lost her memories of her time in the world of dreams, would she forget Gaidal completely? Would she forget herself? She clenched her teeth. "It's the last battle, fool woman," she thought. "Who cares about that?" But she did. A question had begun to haunt her. What if, in being cast out of the world of dreams, Birgitta had been broken from the horn? She didn't know if it was possible. She no longer remembered enough to tell. But if she had, she'd lose Gaidal forever. Outside, leaves crunched, twigs cracking. The clatter was so loud, she would have sworn that 1,000 soldiers were marching past, though she knew the Fist of Trollocs was only 50 strong. Still, 50 had her band outnumbered. She didn't worry. Though she complained to Elaine that she didn't know much about warfare, this hiding in a forest with a team of well-trained companions, this she'd done before, dozens of times, perhaps hundreds, though her memories were so fuzzy she couldn't say for certain. When the Trollocs were nearly all the way past, she and her Aiel burst from cover. The brutes had started down the false trail made by the two Aiel men earlier, and Birgitta attacked them from behind, downing a number of Trollocs with arrows before the rest were able to react. Trollocs did not die easily. They could often take 2 or 3 arrows before slowing. Well, that only happened when you missed the eyes or the throat. She never did. Monster after monster dropped to her bow. The Trollocs had begun downslope of the cave, which meant every one she or the Aiel killed was another corpse the others had to try to climb over to reach her. 50 became 30 in mere seconds. As that 30 rushed upward, half of the Aiel pulled out spears and engaged them, while Birgitta and the others took a few steps downslope and flanked the Trollocs. 20 became 10, who tried to flee. Despite the wooded landscape, they were easy to pick off.
though it meant hitting them in the legs or back of the neck, taking them down so that spears could finish them off. 10 of the Aiel saw to the Trollocs, sticking a spear in each one to make certain it was dead. Others gathered arrows. Birgitta pointed to Nichil and Ludin, 2 of the Aiel, and they joined her to scout the area. Her steps felt familiar. These woods felt familiar. Not just because of past lives she could no longer remember. During her centuries spent living in the world of dreams, she and Gaidal had spent many a year in these forests. She remembered his caress upon her cheek, her neck. "I can't lose this," she thought, fighting down panic. "Light, I can't. Please." She didn't know what was happening to her. She could remember something, a faint discussion about what? She had lost it. People couldn't be unbound from the horn, could they? Hawkwing might know. She'd have to ask him. Unless she had already. "Burn me." Movement in the forest stopped her cold. She crouched down next to a rock, bow out in front of her. Underbrush crackled close at hand. Nichil and Ludin had vanished at the first sound. Light, but they were good. It took her a moment to pick them out, hiding nearby. She raised a finger, pointed at herself, then pointed before her. She would scout. They would cover her. Birgitta moved silently. She'd show these Aiel that they weren't the only ones who knew how to avoid detection. Besides, these were her woods. She wouldn't be shown up by a bunch of desert folk. She moved stealthily, avoiding thickets of withered thorn bushes. Were there more of those around of late? They seemed to be one of the only plants that hadn't died off completely. The ground smelled stale in a way that no forest should, though that was overpowered by the stench of death and rot. She passed another group of fallen Trollocs. The blood on them was dry. They were several days dead. Elaine ordered her forces to bring back their dead. Thousands upon thousands of Trollocs moved through these woods like crawling beetles. Elaine wanted them to find only their own dead, hoping it would give them reason to fear. Birgitta moved toward the sounds. She saw large shadows approaching in the dim light. Trollocs, sniffing at the air. The creatures continued to press through the woods. They were forced to avoid the roads where an ambush of dragons could prove deadly. Elaine's plan called for teams like the one Birgitta led to hack away at the Trollocs, leading groups of them off into the woods, whittling down their numbers. This group was far too big for her team to take, unfortunately. Birgitta withdrew, waving for the Aiel to follow, and slipped quietly back toward camp.
That night, following his failure with Lan's army, Rand fled to his dreams. He sought out his Valley of Peace, appearing amid a grove of wild cherry trees in full bloom, their perfume lacing the air. With those beautiful pink-throated white blossoms, the trees almost looked aflame. Rand wore simple Two Rivers clothing. After months in a king's garments of brilliant colors and soft textures, the loose wool trousers and linen felt very comfortable. He placed sturdy boots on his feet, like those he'd worn growing up. They fit him in a way that no new boot, no matter how well made, ever would. He wasn't allowed old boots any longer. If his boots showed a hint of wear, one servant or another made them vanish. Rand stood up in the Dream Hills and made himself a walking staff. He then began to walk upward through the mountains. This wasn't a real place, not any longer. He'd crafted it from memory and desire, somehow mixing both familiarity and a sense of exploration. It smelled fresh, of overturned leaves and sap. Animals moved in the underbrush. A hawk cried somewhere distant. Luz Theron had known how to create dream shards like this. Though he had not been a dreamer, most Aes Sedai of that era had made use of Teleion Riad in one way or another. One thing they learned was how to slice out a dream for themselves, a haven within their own mind, more controlled than regular dreams. They learned how to enter a fragment like this while meditating, somehow giving the body rest as real as sleep. Luz Theron had known these things, and more. How to reach into someone's mind if they entered his dream shard, how to tell if someone else had invaded his dreams, how to expose his dreams to others. Luz Theron had liked to know things, like a traveler who wanted to have one of everything useful in his rucksack. Luz Theron had rarely used these tools. He'd left them stored on a back shelf in his mind, gathering dust. Would things have gone differently if he'd taken time each night to wander a peaceful valley such as this? Rand didn't know, and, truth be told, this valley was no longer safe. He passed a deep cavern. He'd left them stored on a back shelf in his mind, gathering dust. Would things have gone differently if he'd taken time each night to wander a peaceful valley such as this? Rand didn't know, and, truth be told, this valley was no longer safe. He passed a deep cavern to his left. He had not put it there. Another attempt by Moradin to draw him? Rand passed it by without looking. The forest didn't seem as alive as it had moments ago. Rand kept walking, trying to enforce his will upon the land. He had not practiced that enough, however. So, as he walked, the forest grayed, looking washed out. The cavern came again. Rand stopped at its mouth. Cold, humid air blew out over him, chilling his skin, smelling of fungus. Rand cast aside his walking staff, then strode into the cavern. As he passed into darkness, he wove a globe of white-blue light and hung it beside his head. The glow reflected from the wet stone, shining on smooth knobs and clefts. Panting echoed from deep within the cavern. It was followed by gasps. And splashes. Rand walked forward, though by now he had guessed what this was. He had begun to wonder if she would try again. He came to a small chamber, perhaps 10 paces wide at the end of the tunnel, where the stone sank down into a clear pool of water, perfectly circular. The blue depths seemed to extend downward forever. A woman in a white dress struggled to stay afloat in the center of it. The fabric of her dress rippled in the water, forming a circle. Her face and hair were wet. As Rand watched, she gasped and sank, flailing in the crystalline water. She came up a moment later, gasping. "Hello, Mieren," Rand said softly. His hand formed into a fist. He would not jump into that water to rescue her. This was a dream shard. That pool could actually be water, but more likely it represented something else. His arrival seemed to buoy her, and her vigorous thrashings became more effective.
"Luz Theron,"
she said, wiping her face with one hand, panting. Light, where was his peace? He felt like a child again, a boy who thought Barillon the grandest city ever built. Yes, her face was different, but faces were no longer of much matter to him. She was still the same person. Of all the Forsaken, only Lanfear had chosen her new name. She had always wanted one of those. He remembered. He remembered. Walking into grand parties with her on his arm, her laughter over the music, their nights alone. He had not wanted to remember making love to another woman, particularly not to one of the Forsaken. But he could not pick and choose what was in his mind. Those memories mixed with his own, when he had desired her as the Lady Selene. A foolish, youthful lust. He no longer felt these things, but the memories of them remained.
"You can free me, Luz Theron,"
Lanfear said.
He has claimed me. Must I beg? He has claimed me.
You pledged yourself to the Shadow, Mieren, Rand said. This is your reward. You expect pity from me? A dark something reached up and wrapped around her legs, yanking her down into the abyss again. Despite his words, Rand found himself stepping forward, as if to leap into the pool. He held himself back. He finally felt like a whole person again, after a long fight. That gave him strength. But in his peace was a weakness, the weakness he had always feared, the weakness that Moiraine had rightfully spotted in him, the weakness of compassion. He needed it, like a helmet needed a hole through which to see. Both could be exploited. He admitted to himself that it was true. Lanfear surfaced, sputtering, looking helpless.
"Must I beg?"
she said again. "I don't think you're capable of it." She lowered her eyes.
"Please,"
she whispered. Rand's insides twisted. He had fought through darkness himself in seeking the light. He had given himself a second chance. Should he not give one to another? Light. He wavered, remembering what it had felt like in that moment seizing the true power. That agony and that thrill. That power and that horror. Lanfear had given herself to the Dark One. But in a way, Rand had as well. He looked into her eyes, searching them, knowing them. Finally, Rand shook his head. "You've grown better at this kind of deception, Mieren, but not good enough." Her expression darkened. In a moment, the pool was gone, replaced by a stone floor. Lanfear sat there, cross-legged, in her silver-white dress, wearing her new face, but still the same. "So you are back," she said, sounding not entirely pleased.
"Well, I am no longer forced to deal with a simple farm boy. That is some small blessing."
Rand snorted, entering the chamber. She was still imprisoned. He could sense a darkening around her, like a dome of shadow, and he stayed outside of it. The pool, however, the act of drowning, had been mere theatrics. She was prideful, but was not above maintaining a weak front when the situation required it. If he'd been able to embrace Luz Theron's memories earlier, Rand would never have been fooled so easily by her in the waste.
"Then I shall address you not as a damsel in need of a hero," Lanfear said, eyeing him as he walked around her prison, "but as an equal, seeking asylum."
"An equal," Rand said, laughing. "Since when have you ever considered anyone your equal, Mieren?"
"You care nothing for my captivity?"
"It pains me," Rand said. "But no more than it pained me when you swore yourself to the Shadow. Did you know I was there when you revealed it? You did not see me, as I did not want to be seen. But I was watching. Light, Mieren. You swore to kill me."
"Did I mean it?"
she asked, turning to look him in the eyes. Had she? No, she had not meant it. Not then. Lanfear did not kill people that she thought would be useful, and she had always considered him useful.
"We shared something special once," she said. "You were my—"
"I was an ornament to you," Rand snapped. He breathed deeply, trying to calm himself. Light, but it was hard around her. "The past is done. I care nothing for it, and would gladly give you a second chance at the light. Unfortunately, I know you.
You're just doing it again. Playing us all, including the Dark One.